Ladies and gentlemen, people of the world, unite. Today is a special day. We are back in the Most High Show new studio. We are hanging out. We have a crew here. We've been eating pizza. We've been hanging out. We've been talking shit. It's been great. And today we have a special guest. Really excited to do this. We're at the table, one-on-one interview style. Today our guest is Eric. He is a writer, a YouTuber, a comedian, which I just found that out. A mental health professional and an advocate for mental health, and he's our guest on the Most High Show. So everybody, please give a round of applause for Eric and the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right, so Eric, if you can, just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of who you are and what you do today.
I think I'm a regular guy. I work at a substance abuse treatment center that is primarily addiction. Primarily serve people struggling with addiction and some mental health struggles. And I just finished my first novel. Writing keeps me sane. So my first novel, I Got Sober for This, it's in the final stages.
Oh, that's the title, is I Got Sober for This. Oh, what a fascinating title.
Yeah, so that's my title, and that's my book, and that's been my baby for the past 5 years. That's pretty much what I do. I work at the treatment center. I get off work at 11 p.m. or midnight. Everyone's asleep. And that's my time to myself to sit and write, and keeps me sane. Yeah. And I always have to have a creative outlet. Without a creative outlet, no amount of medication can keep me sane without art. Mm. And I do take medication, but yeah. I need art too.
Yeah. Art is medication.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So you work in treatment and then you write at night in the wee hours in the morning while mm-hmm. we're all sleeping.
Yes.
So you got to. Can you give us just a little bit about the book?
Yes, it is about. The backdrop is the mental health system doesn't serve people with mental illness very well, mm-hmm. like schizophrenia, mm-hmm. and things. Anything where you would experience what is called anosognosia, which is lack of insight. So people, when I was in the hospital, I would look around and be like, "Why am I here? These people are crazy." But I was acting just like them. And basically, a lot of these people wind up on the streets, jails, or dead. So it's a recovered alcoholic lawyer who's, now that he's sober, he could be there for his brother with schizophrenia. And he also gets caught up in cases that maybe aren't as lucrative as the ones that pay his bills, but he does it because he cares.
So this is a fiction.
It's a fictional book.
Yeah, which allows you this creative space to really dive into the real issues.
Yes, and yeah. It's the creative space that it gives me. But also, though, a lot of times when I'm advocating, I feel powerless because there's people I want to help that I can't. So when I'm writing, I have complete control of that page. So it gives me a sense of control, and it's very therapeutic to write.
Oh, wow. Hmm? All right, so the book is called...
I Got Sober for This,
okay.
with 3 periods.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, yeah, not a question mark.
It's... Yeah. It's not a pile of shit emoji.
Yeah.
awesome. And so is this a book that you're going to release or self-publish?
It will be released in October. It's in the final stages of editing.
Oh.
And I plan to release it first on Amazon Kindle Direct Publishing on both Kindle and paperback.
Yeah.
And I plan to have it there in October. And being this my first time doing it, and it's very much a passion project, mm-hmm. I thought it'd already be out. But being that I'm still learning, I'm confident it will be out in October, but I can't really set a date because mm-hmm. I did hire a friend to help me edit it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's in like the final stages of being edited.
Yeah.
And then I should have it on Amazon Direct. And then I'll probably go to Apple Books. And then from there, I'll look around and see how to get it into bookstores and just just try to market the book.
Yeah. I love that about Amazon. A lot of people don't know that, but it's really, they make it pretty straightforward. I mean, it's quite a process, but to get to, for an author to publish, to self-publish, and to make their books available on Kindle, and then I think on the with the paperback, they print it to order.
They print it to order, yeah. And I had no idea this was available. Yeah. I honestly would be like, why am I writing this when no one's going to publish it? And it's one of those things, if I just do the work, trust the process, things tend to work out.
So you've been writing this book 5 years.
Yes.
Not knowing that you had an option to self-publish.
No, not knowing I had the option to self-publish. Yeah. And wondering how I was going to get it published.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, it's therapy. Yeah. I do desperately want to get it out. I want other people to see it.
Yeah.
But that was kind of like in the back of my head, you're writing this big book that no one's ever going to read.
Yeah.
And then I was able to, like I said, it's just do the work. And what really helped me was Stephen King's memoir on writing. He helped me a lot, and a lot of what he said was, you got to write it. You can write it, and you can worry about publishing later.
Yeah,
had a lot of other great advice in there, like you can't be a writer without being a reader. So I had to step up my game. When I'd have writer's block, I'd have to just, okay, you got writer's block, go read. Yeah. And then one thing I learned was, this wasn't in Stephen King's book, but the shower effect. If I'm stumped, I can't really think of anything, go take a shower, go kind of maybe fold some laundry, doesn't take a lot of mental or physical energy.
Yeah.
And then I'll just think of something while I'm doing it, go back and start writing.
Yeah. It opens up the space for the subconscious to play around because you're busy. Yeah. That's really cool. And I think like what you're talking about as a creative is there's this need to create. But along with that, there is an attachment to like what we create. We do want it to be appreciated at some level, you know, like I make music and that's my therapy. And I used to do that very aspirationally, you know, and then I had kind of a click and it was like, I'm just going to make this music. And so a couple of my friends who buy the album on Bandcamp, you know, they listen to it and they'll text me that they like the songs and stuff. And I'm like, cool. I need some sort of reflection back for the art. Yeah. Right.
And that was something that was hard for me. I did show some of the early chapters to people because I needed that recognition that I had something.
Yeah.
Just to help with me with my confidence. So yeah. I did have a lot of my friends have read chapter one, and I got that recognition of, hey, we want to see what happens.
Yeah.
And then I had a lot of help for one of the earlier drafts. A friend of mine from church read it in its entirety. And so that
helped. God bless them, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, and he did me a favor because I changed the names of my characters a lot. But I didn't always go back through
and fix it.
He's like, you'd have like a mark, like, who is that? So that helped me get it ready to be edited.
Yeah.
And being that it was the first book I'd ever written, the first time I sent it to the editor, she said, I can't edit it. It's not really, because I was always told, don't tell the reader, show the reader. Mm-hmm. So I tried to like explain everything with dialogue. And the person I sent it to was like, hey, this is not, I can't edit this. So then I was really discouraged, like, what am I going to do? And then I took out a lot of the dialogue and added some narration and scene description.
Yeah.
Because every book needs a combination of both.
Yeah. Well, that's a fascinating topic. We can talk about that for more. But tonight, the topic is mental health versus mental illness. So that was a topic you came to us, said this is what I want to talk about. Can you break down the difference and why is this distinction important?
The distinction is very important because, first off, let me tell you what the distinction is. The distinction, mental health would be, say, inflation is really affecting a lot of people's mental health. That's a situational thing. Mm. People in a stressful job or a toxic work environment, that's mental health. someone who, say, is going through a divorce, that's really going to affect someone's mental health. Mental illness, these things would affect them too, but something like schizophrenia needs medication. And sometimes it needs to be handled. They need a different level of care than someone who's struggling with their mental health because of something that they have going on. That is perfectly understandable. And that is something that I've struggled with, of knowing when is there a situation that's affecting my mental health, and when is it the mental illness?
Yeah, so would then it be kind of like mental illness is a biological...
In my opinion, schizoaffective disorder, which I have, and is a combination of schizophrenia and depression, it could also be a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Mm. In my view, I view it as a biological disease or illness, but I'm open to the possibility of environmental triggers. I don't like going down the rabbit hole of playing the blame game, because right. That leads into what's this saying? Shame, blame, and mother blame. Mm-hmm. I don't blame my parents or something of that nature. But yeah, I am open to an environmental trigger. I just don't know what that is.
Right. Yeah. So if you're taking a medicine to treat an illness, I guess some people, when somebody suffers a tragic loss, mm-hmm. right, it's not uncommon for doctors to prescribe them a sleeping aid or highly powerful anti-anxiety medicine mm-hmm. or something, because it's such a traumatic and tough mm-hmm. event, and that person can't sleep. And so a person, an earther, a normal person, or would take that medicine for a short period of time and then begin to deal with the grief and mm-hmm. learn to move on. Yeah. Right. So that would be mental health and treating mental health.
Yeah. That would be a mental health treatment. And yeah, there's, like I said, there's nothing wrong if you got something going on and you work with a physician and take medicine for it. But in my case, I plan to take medication for the rest of my life.
Yeah. What other mental illness diagnoses would you consider are like that, like this schizoaffective disorder?
I honestly would say bipolar disorder, and I think major depressive disorder. And I believe those are three that I would definitely say. And as far as that, I'm sure there are others, but those are the three that come to mind right now.
Yeah. Okay. So you're open about your mental health diagnosis.
Yes.
All right. And tell me about, when did you learn? When did you receive that diagnosis?
Well, it's kind of when I received the diagnosis, or when I can say with absolute certainty I was told, are two different things. Oh. Because I was very much not in a good headspace. So I did what was called double booking, where I knew what my delusions were, sounded bizarre. So I would keep them to myself and only say what wouldn't, what would be like acceptable to say in that situation.
Yeah.
So when I first went to the doctor, I had a very good psychiatrist and social worker. They diagnosed me with depression, because even though I view it as it's biological, there's no blood test. So if what is being represented to the doctor, that's what they're going to go on. Yeah. And then while I was seeing them, it got to the point where I couldn't keep anything to myself. And then I was diagnosed somewhere along the lines when I was with schizophrenia or schizoaffective. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the exact diagnosis was. I know now it's schizoaffective. But I remember with absolute certainty at 19, I was told I had it. But if I was told before then, I just don't remember.
So you're 19 years old and you receive this diagnosis. Mm-hmm. What's that like at 19? What's life
going
on? To
me, it was awful, because I view it was necessary. It was necessary for me to be diagnosed with an accurate diagnosis. But to me, it was just like all these things that I didn't think. I don't want to go into too much detail about my delusions.
Yeah.
But it was very frustrating that I didn't think these things. I knew these things.
Yeah. Right.
And being told they're not real.
yeah,
was this like a huge, like just brick wall. It was just a horrible yeah. feeling, but like it was necessary because schizophrenia related disorders. I believe I've heard the term toxic psychosis. The longer you go untreated, the more brain damage happens. Mm. So the reason I'm working and sitting here now and able to do these things is because I got early treatment. So like, even though it's not a pleasant experience and that's an understatement, but it had to be done. I had to get on my meds to make the rest of my life better.
Yeah. It's definitely not one of the cool mental illnesses. Mm-mm. You know, there's a lot of stigma around mm-hmm. that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you came in and we talked, I think last week or so, and we talked about you coming being on the show, I thought that was so refreshing and bold mm-hmm. that you were so open and honest about, because it's a very stigmatized.
And stigma, I had a lot of self-stigma, thinking less of myself and affecting my self-image. But the term stigma, I really think, is overused, in mm-hmm. my opinion, because I think a lot of it is prejudice and discrimination.
Yeah.
And I feel like when it comes to other people that have people that are groups that have people that are prejudiced and discriminated against, saying it's stigma, it kind of gives the prejudiced person a pass.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'll never fully know why someone doesn't care to have me around, but I have friends. Okay. If it costs me a job, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Or if they used to have, if I can't get health, the prescription I need, and they're like, well, who's going to go on TV and or go call a radio station and say, my son or brother can't get the help he needs for schizophrenia. That's part of the reason we led to such gaps in insurance coverage mm-hmm. is people didn't want to speak openly about it.
Right.
So that was kind of like, well, am I going to sit here and complain about it, or am I going to do something?
Yeah.
But that is something I thought a lot about, is do I want to disclose all this stuff? And I decided it was kind of, if it's therapeutic for me to go out and advocate. So that way when, say, I have a family member or hear of something happening, I could look myself in the face and say I did everything I could.
Yeah.
And not that I just didn't do anything. but no one knows I have schizoaffective disorder. So I
right.
Yeah. So like I said, for me to sleep at night, I have to go out and do advocacy.
Yeah. Okay. Now, before we get into the next question, I know this isn't on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Hope this doesn't throw you off too much.
No worries.
But you did have some other issues with drinking.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
So do you... You know, I like, we did a documentary called Megan's Prayer. It's about mental health and suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And so we interviewed Dr. Britt Paramore. He's not a doctor, counselor, Britt Paramore. And he was talking about the difficulty in treating people who come in for substance use disorder who also have a mental health diagnosis mm-hmm. and the complexities of like what's causing what. And, mm-hmm. you know, or like I always say, like when I went to treatment, I was on blood pressure medicine, right? Because I was doing a bunch of cocaine. So my mm-hmm. blood pressure was high. Once I stopped doing cocaine, I didn't need the blood pressure medicine, mm-hmm. right? So some people, once they stop using a substance, mm-hmm. the mental health disorder or whatever is no longer existing. Mm-hmm. Is there any correlation between your mental illness and the drinking?
I didn't start drinking until after I was already having symptoms and diagnosed. Like, I couldn't drink at all my older medications, and my recovery took multiple steps where mm-hmm. medication came out. The medication that made me able to go to college and rejoin the workforce didn't come out to 2011. Wow. And I developed this in the late 90s.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really do a whole lot. And a lot of the drinking was because I wanted to, where am I going to meet people? I didn't know anyone. So like, I've been given medication, not like, yeah, I'm 30. I can go live my life, but I don't know. If you go to a bar, you could pretty much talk to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And when I drank, something clicked and I felt confident, didn't have self-pity. And but I couldn't stop. And it was just like, I was allergic to it. One drop would make me want more. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, well, I must not have my medication right, or I must need to get something out in therapy, or I must need more confidence. Like when I was at Kennesaw State, I got really involved in the public speaking club Toastmasters. And I thought public speaking will give me the confidence and I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. Mm. And then when I'm quit drinking, I don't like to disclose what 12 the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes alcohol as an allergy. Mm-hmm. So once I accepted that it was like tobacco for me, one cigarette makes me a chain smoker, mm-hmm. one drink makes me a barfly. Mm-hmm. And once I accepted that, I was able to stop. Another thing I had to accept was alcoholism and schizoaffective disorder are equally get equal attention. I still see my psychiatrist. I still take my medicine, but I attend meetings regularly.
Yeah. So you say they get equal attention, meaning the maintenance or the treatment, the continued treatment of them. Mm-hmm. You treat them equally and yes. separately.
And getting my medication right won't make me drink normally. and a spiritual 12-step program won't. I'll still need my medicine.
Yeah.
So they go hand, and I do say one thing with absolute. I am not a doctor. if someone were to come to me and say, "Hey, I'm talking to my doctor, and now that I've been sober, I might not need all these medications," I'm gonna say, "Good, talk to your doctor."
Yeah.
But I've experienced a little bit, not a lot, but of people being like, "Oh, you don't need those meds."
Yeah.
Because when I quit drinking, I didn't need them.
Yeah.
So therefore, right. you don't need them.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't need that. Yeah. Please don't do that. Please stop doing that, guys. Stop doing that. Stop trying to be someone's doctor. It's not working. You're not a physician.
We're not your doctor, lawyer, banker.
No, we're not. A bunch of uncle grandpas out there talking shit that they shouldn't be. Speak what you know. Speak what you know. Keep it simple. One day at a time. Easy does it. Stay right there. Okay. So you talked about the different, like, stigma kind of lessening prejudice and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And have you experienced that in your professional life?
I honestly don't think I have professionally, because let's just say I make a mistake at work because I'm flustered. Okay, a lot of writers don't necessarily make mistakes under stress. Hmm. Well, whether I had not been open with a diagnosis or not, that would still be an issue if I mess up. So I honestly don't think that I think there's a difference between maybe my action causing, say, hey, maybe that's a little too much to put on Eric's plate, is different if it's based on an action than just saying, oh, he disclosed something. And as far as at my work, I can't think of a time there may be things I don't know about, but I don't think I was ever discriminated against professionally.
Yeah.
Like when I was trying to work in sales, it was, my mental illness was an issue, but I wasn't making my numbers. I don't think anyone would have cared if my numbers had been good.
Uh-huh.
So mental illness has affected me professionally, but I don't see it as discrimination from the employer.
Right. And I love that you're making that separation, because the way you talk about it is that you have to pace yourself
professionally
and kind of know your limitations.
Know my limitations and know that it's okay to pace myself and know my limitations. Because if I medicalize this, I'm doing 10 things at once. Man, my schizoaffective disorder is acting up. I'm like, no, I can't. A lot of people that don't have a mental illness can't multitask at that extent. So knowing that, and it reminds me, when I was in college, I was studying geographical information science. And I kept thinking the ARC map that we used, that's really stressful for me. My mental illness is acting up. Well, it's stressful for a lot of people, and that's just not where my aptitude and my skill set is.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, I had to go maybe find something else for me to do. But I was really being stubborn, thinking I had to get my medication right and not just thinking, hey, maybe this isn't the major for me.
Yeah. You used the word medicalize.
Yeah, medicalizing my emotions. Medicalizing my emotions, like, man, this is really, like, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but yeah. I had a traumatic experience a couple of years ago, and I was like, man, my mental illness was really making me feel this way or that way. And a friend of mine said, Eric, I don't have a mental illness, and that would make me very, very upset. Yeah. But my go-to, and the Georgia Consumer Network for Certified Peer Specialist, which was great, which is a great program. They talk about that a lot, about not medicalizing what you feel. Hmm. It's okay if, you know, this is not really a good fit for me. I don't have to invoke my mental illness to say that. It's like, man, this is not. And it's one of those. Yeah. And it's not like I'm a robot that will thrive in any environment, because that means my mental health is acting up, or my schizoaffective is acting up if I can't do that. And just like I say, not medicalizing emotions. And like I said, I love the right. And a lot of people that love the right and storytelling, and I do taking a break from stand up because I've just been so focused on getting my book out there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of artists aren't always don't get when I get flustered. It's like, is that mental illness or is that just me being a writer who gets flustered?
Right, exactly. And I think I was talking to somebody today. And we were talking about motives, mm-hmm. what we do, and what's the motive behind why you're doing this, right? And to get honest about your motives, but without judging the motive.
Mm-hmm.
So that once you're honest, like, oh, yeah, I'm really doing this because I want someone's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can be honest and then not judge yourself for doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a freedom that comes from that, I think. And I think it seems like medicalizing, and I think people do this a lot with addiction or alcoholism, mm-hmm. though. Well, I'm just an addict. I'm just an alcoholic. That's why I can't do this. That's why I'm not whatever, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of medicalizing
their own, yeah.
Spiritual condition. And so to be able to just be honest with your limitations,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think like for years, and this is kind of like back in the day, it was like if you were weak in an area, you needed to strengthen yourself, right? Like I'm an independent. I've been independent for, you know, 10, 12 years. And so I was kind of in the beginning of going independent was like, oh, I needed to be strong in the areas that I was weak.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized what I need to do is double down in the areas that I'm mm-hmm. strong in. Because when I do that, then I will attract the right people who can do the things that I don't do well. You know, and sometimes I got to swallow the frog and open a fucking spreadsheet up, you know, which mm-hmm. is like,
yeah,
yeah, I got to do that in the morning. And, you know, it's a thing for me, you know, mm-hmm. I am a creative, so I can do that. I've disciplined myself to approach it and do it because it needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I know that like, I got to do it in the morning. I know that I'm not going to be doing creative tasks afterwards. I know that's going to suck my brain dry.
Mm-hmm.
I can get into a flow state with it, but it took a long time. But I think for so long, I would just tell myself I wasn't. Well, I'm just not good at that. I'm just like I'm a creative. I shouldn't be doing this. Instead of just saying this is harder for me,
mm-hmm.
it's going to take me more time. I need to slow down. I need to put some music on. I need to pay attention, and. Mm. That's okay,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah.
I've experienced that because there's parts of any job that I enjoy more than others, but I still have to do the things that maybe I have to slow down and do.
Yeah.
And the same thing with art. I have a YouTube channel for the National Shattering Silence Coalition, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, I don't want to I like interviewing and writing. I still have to learn how to use Adobe Premiere to get my videos out. Because no one's going to do it for me,
right?
And nor should they. There are certain basic things that, as an artist, I still have to do.
Yeah.
Even though technology is not my strong suit,
yeah.
There's things I accept the fact that there's things I have to do, and I don't have to. I could do that without medicalizing it.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, this is my illness. I'm not good with a lot of learning new programs. I can still learn programs, do my share to support my art.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, without turn it into a medical thing.
What is the National Shattering Silence Coalition?
Thank you. Yes. We are a group of, there's a lot of people in my opinion, people with schizophrenia don't get the resources they need. And when the what we are, to answer your question, we're a group of people with lived experience with schizophrenia-related disorders and bipolar disorder, and families and clinicians, and we try to close gaps in services to make sure that people can get the help they need. Because what saved my life and made my life a lot differently is I was in a clinical trial at Emory University, and I agreed to take my medication because they paid me to participate in the study. And I wouldn't be able to do it without early intervention. I wouldn't have been able to have a life like that I'm living. And just making sure that people can get the help they need and don't wind up in coffins, jails, and homeless.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when the hospitals started closing in the 60s, there wasn't a warm handoff between the community mental health centers that the federal government established. They wanted to go focus on mental health, like stress and like people that stressed at work and like divorces. And they didn't coordinate with the hospitals that were discharging people. Well, that makes it the family's responsibility. And I'm sorry, the families still don't have the resources they need. And there's a program that we really support called assisted outpatient treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it is. There is a time for mandatory treatment when someone has schizophrenia and are going to wind up and are going to wind up just not in a good place. Like, and also, but the thing is, there's a legal criteria to do it.
Yeah.
It would be like a doctor petitioning the judge. They would have a lawyer.
Yeah.
It stops at the end of the year. And I've seen a lot of people really that were in psychosis when these programs are done right, really being able to go out and live lives. And recovery looks different. Sometimes people are in the program, the AOT program, and they're never able to rejoin the workforce, but that's okay.
Yeah.
But there's a good chance they would have been able to rejoin the workforce had they been treated earlier and the schizophrenia not damaged their brain as much.
Yeah. When we used to live in California, and my in-laws ran a home health place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this might be kind of a California state thing, but their home health thing was they had they served people with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived, it was kind of like a halfway house kind of situation. So they were fed meals and they were given the medicine and kind of, so I guess they were probably in a stage where it was like a maintenance and them trying to live and go to work. And but they still had a community that they were gathering together. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that's California state, because I think it was like a Medicaid thing, right?
Yeah.
That the state would pay their housing and their medicine and the food and all that kind of stuff, because they needed kind of a higher level of care, but they didn't need to be institutionalized.
That is the big, my friend Teresa Pascani really advocates for a thing called housing that heals, because there is a huge gap between, there's living with your mom or in your own apartment and the hospital. But what you're saying, yeah, there needs to be something in between.
Yeah.
And a big thing that needs to happen is a social worker has to be like, when I talk to people that are trying to help the homeless, it's almost like they're a spaceman untethered in space. There's no one responsible for checking up on them.
Yeah.
So you can't say, okay, there's a very vulnerable human in our community. Okay, what's going on with them? There's no one to really call and say, hey, I saw so and so like eating out of a dumpster. What's going on?
Right.
Like, is he off his meds?
Yeah.
And that's something that does exist in some places, but often it doesn't.
Yeah.
And then
And it's a lot, like, I think there's a lot more resources for people under 18, right?
Yeah.
I think there's more programs, there's more government assistance, but the moment that, and I think not just mental health or mental illness disabilities, but physical disabilities, you know, people with mobility issues or extreme autism, when they cross into this adult, they kind of break that threshold into adulthood. There's not as much resources to support them. And so if the family is not able to dump resources into it, right? Mm-hmm. And you got to think that the family's been caring for this individual,
yeah,
right? Which could be a very a spectrum of issues, right? And mm-hmm. and so when someone crosses into adulthood, it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes very difficult, you know. Like we just did a documentary. My friend Mitchell, and this is what his whole thing is about giving adults with disabilities community integration,
mm-hmm.
right? And so taking people out of the home and having them have integrative experiences and mm-hmm. going to the movies or rock climbing but you know, he's doing it and he's creating a nonprofit because there's just not, families don't have the resources to pay for that.
Yes.
Right.
And families don't have the resources to pay for that. And a lot of the programs like Medi-Cal in California, their version of Medicaid, has a really great early psychosis program mm-hmm. to help people. But people that maybe have more money and have good insurance, it's not good for that early psychosis program.
Oh.
So a lot of times there's just gaps, random places that you wouldn't yeah. even expect. So like when I was trying to get services for a family member, Highland Rivers was saying that my family member couldn't be in their residential treatment program because Medicare that he had through disability made him too wealthy.
Oh.
And it was for people that lack services.
Oh.
And a lot of times with that, like I said, out of the blue, there'll just be like a gap will show up. And that's sometimes people will like give me advice. Oh, I did this and it really worked out well for me. And then like the family calls up and like, oh, well, you don't meet the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
So making sure these programs are available for everyone. And also, what else? Oh, yeah, one thing I was going to say that was very vital to my recovery, instrumental in my recovery, I would even say, is National Association of Mental Illness Cobb County had a support group called NAMI Connections, and which is people with lived experience that have a support group
mm-hmm.
facilitated by other people with a mental illness. And then the families have a family-to-family group.
Oh, really?
Yes. So NAMI in Georgia, different NAMIs are run differently,
mm-hmm.
but NAMI Georgia is great.
Wow. We need to have someone from there to come on.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so I had no idea. So there's a support group, so you can be around peers and around people to, I guess, what the same thing we experience in recovery, right? To not
yeah.
feel alone, to share experiences, to, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome.
Share experiences. And, yeah, so NAMI Georgia does a lot of good. And the thing is, part of the thing is that I've seen a lot of the past 20 years is it reminds me of the book Bowling Alone about how Americans don't join things anymore.
Mm.
So a lot of people, like their loved one will be, say, incarcerated with a mental illness, but like we heard about NAMI through someone at our church, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't, if you don't join anything, you don't really have that connection yeah. where no one's gonna like,
yeah.
no one's really gonna know where, National Association of Mental Illness.
Yeah.
And even some people are plugged in and they just, maybe we need to do better at getting the word out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had no idea that was something, and I that's definitely something I like to get the word out. And I know that every single parent who calls me about their kid, you know, and I recommend support group for them,
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that 97% of them don't go.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're like, well, I'm not the one with the issue. It's clearly that, you know, and it is. It's interesting that people don't want to participate in that. And it's, you know, I think it's like, it's kind of paradoxical, right? Because it's like the thing that you think may be bringing you shame and it's so heavy and you think that you don't want to bring into a community environment, but then you bring it into a community environment and it becomes a source of strength mm-hmm. for yourself and for other people, right? And you learn how other people have dealt with somebody in that issue. But I think that for those of us who are alcoholic and addicts, we just got forced into those rooms, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, I didn't volunteer, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, life just got hard enough to where I was like, fine, I'll do it, right? And I think people who are supporting someone with a substance abuse disorder or a mental health issue, right? Like, they need a community. They need people that they can talk to, people that would understand the small details and the small things that it, what it takes, right, to deal with somebody and to love and to care for someone in that situation. So that's really cool. So we need to look this up, and maybe we'll put this in the description. So one thing I want to reiterate, which is you said it a couple times, which is that you had, I guess, intervention early on with the diagnosis, and that's what you you feel like attributed to that. And then also that there was advancements in the medicine.
Early intervention, advancement in the medicine, and also I was never told that it was always treated as a temporary setback. When the older medicine, I couldn't do a whole lot. It was like, just keep doing it and pray that a newer medication comes out.
Who told you that?
I think it was, I told myself that a lot, but my mother was like, okay, Eric, you're going to go, back when they had North Metro Technical College, I went up and I went to school. Well, I had cognitive issues, and she's like, well, just stick with it. Stick with it, and then hopefully something better will come along.
That's beautiful. So yeah. She believed you.
Yeah.
Believed so, in you past the...
Yeah, my whole university education and all of the things I've done would not have been possible without my mother.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm. That's beautiful. All right, so what do you want... This is our last question. What do you want people to know about mental health? And then also, same question, what do you want people to know about mental illness?
Mental health, I want people to know that, first off, it's okay if you are in a situation that's affecting your mental health, that's okay. It's not, I've read the John Delaney book about, it was on the Dave Ramsey show about anxiety. Mm-hmm. When some situational things, people will be like, oh my God, I have anxiety because I'm in this situation. And sometimes your work-life balance is toxic. And yes, it's okay to see a doctor. I'm not going to tell you not to see take medication. But sometimes just look at the situation and say, hey, maybe I need to work something out. And also on mental illness, I want people to know, I guess what I would... What's really missing from the debate on, what's missing from the mental illness discourse on mental illness is anosognosia. A lot of people like myself were not being stubborn and not wanting to take our medication.
Yeah.
It was like being a stroke victim. Anosognosia is the damage to your brain by schizophrenia and some types of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia-related disorders.
So it physically is damaging.
Physically, like I'd have pretty sure you can look at an MRI and see the change in the brain from schizophrenia. Whether or not you can see the lack of insight, see that part of the, I don't know that mm-hmm. much. But I know I was not being stubborn when I was refusing medication. I honestly couldn't understand. I could see the other people at the hospital, and I knew why they were there, mm-hmm. but I couldn't see that in myself. Like, yeah. I didn't believe these things to be true that I had delusions on. I knew they were true.
Yeah,
it wasn't just saying, well, he has the right to refuse treatment, and if he winds up on the streets, it's society's fault.
Yeah,
no, society doesn't do that. There needs to be a place for someone to step in and help that person. And also, a lot of times just... Early intervention is key. And a lot of times you can overcome anosognosia without a court order. Mm. Sometimes you can just, when I was in the clinical trial study at Emory University, they were so nice to me and they paid me to be there. So I was waiting on I'm not on disability now, but I was on disability for a long time. And that 20 bucks is 20 bucks, especially back then in the 2000s. And that just being well treated.
You could do something with 20 bucks back then, for real. Yeah.
And it was, but that money was mine. I didn't have to ask anyone for it. And they were so nice to me. I had fun there.
Yeah.
And I agreed to take the medication. Like, I would look forward all week to going there. Mm-hmm. And just early intervention is key, but also you can't abandon someone who's with anosognosia. You can't let someone with anosognosia who's too sick to know they're sick go. That's called abandonment.
Yeah.
They're being abandoned. They're not, psychosis is not a right to be protected. It's a disease to be treated.
Yeah. Well, that's bringing up like an instance, a friend of mine, I don't know what, if he's ever received the actual diagnosis, but it was definitely in crisis, clearly a mental health crisis. And we tried to intervene, right, to get him help. And he was very upset. Somehow he found out who had intervened, right, who had wrote letters to try to get him to be mandatorily, like, you know, get some treatment. So he was very upset, and he was very upset at me. And he happened to send me this text about how mad he was at me, from how could I do this, how could I do this. And it's really hard. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's
hard to talk about it even now, like. And I'm sitting across from my friend, who happens to be a fucking doctor in psychology. So I'm like, dude, what do I do? Right? Like, it's a lot, number one, as a friend.
Because
in some ways, I've lost my friend, right? He's no longer that same person. But there's still this kind of sense of, like, what do I do here? Like, I don't, you know, like, I can't necessarily speak rationally. Because I know where that ends up creating a fight or creating some sort of conflict. And so he said, you know, the best thing for you to do is just say you're sorry and then continue to stay connected to him. And so, all right, I'll do it. You know, right over hash browns, I just said, hey, I'm sorry, you know. And because it was really difficult to, like, I didn't want to feel disingenuous to feed into the, I don't know if they were delusions, but it was more like paranoia. I didn't want to feed into it, but at the same time, I didn't want to make him feel like dismissed. And at a certain point in my relationship with this guy, I had to just kind of go, I can't, from my own self, I can't keep trying because it's starting to jack me up.
Yeah. You know?
And that was a hard decision to come to, but what you're explaining this,
Anna knows Shosha.
Anna Nosoja.
Anna Nosoja, yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't understand that that's what I was dealing with. You know?
Have you ever heard of Javier Amador? He's a psychologist who has a brother with schizophrenia. He wrote the book that I recommend to anyone who works in the mental health field. It's called I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help. It's different than just denial.
Yeah.
It's different than just not being able to admit self. It's like, it's more of a clinical thing, but it is about anosognosia. And I forget the acronym, but he has a LEAP, the LEAP Institute. Listen, emphasize, agree. And then I can't remember what the P stands for, but a lot of times when someone's delusional, just agreeing with them, like, oh, I wouldn't like that happening to me either. I'm really sorry that that's happening. And trying to figure out, okay, how do we like help them? But also, when I could tell you, as someone who's been in complete flight from reality, you could sit there with like documentation, you're just going to upset me.
Yeah.
Because to me, I know it's true and nothing's going to, and it's not stubbornness. It's not, it's like, say, it's a clinical thing. It'd be like going up to someone with Alzheimer's and trying to do the same thing when they're acting out.
Right.
It's not going to, in my view, I wish schizophrenia was more lumped in with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and schizophrenia. I think that's where it belongs.
Yeah.
As a neurological thing. Because I feel the term behavioral health, it's really, like I said, not that behavioral health can't have a medical issue associated with it.
Right.
But you get lumped in with people that need a different level of care.
Yeah.
And what fits someone with, say, Alzheimer's might not fit someone who's stressed at work.
Yeah.
And same thing with schizophrenia. Someone with schizophrenia, I'm employed. I get stressed at work. I could still benefit from that. But if I'm in complete flight from reality, I'm going to need a different level of care. And a lot of times you get kind of lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
Because when I was in psychosis, I was not capable of serving on a commission. So if someone who's maybe more able to come on a show like this, which is a big part of the reason I wanted to do that, I want to do these shows, is we need someone on a commission too that understands that yes, there are people that are too sick to know they're sick.
Yeah.
And it needs to be addressed. And that's something that needs to happen. And I talked to people, I've heard from people in the autistic community mm-hmm. that, yes, people that maybe are able to hold a full-time job with autism or autistic, yes, their needs need to be met, but someone that can't leave the house, just your lived experience isn't necessarily the same as theirs.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when I see peer advocates talk about, well, as someone who's been there, well, have you been there? Because right. Have you ever been to full-blown psychosis? And right. do you ever, like, not even knocking? You're yeah. speaking on behalf of people that you don't really understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways we talk about anything. I think it's an American thing, you know, black and white. You know, you're either healthy or you're sick.
Yeah.
You know, and you're either you have this or you don't. Like somebody who, you know, has an anxiety disorder, that is such a there's such a variation of what that is and how that affects somebody, right? And somebody can be, it's a spectrum. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's like when they talk about autism or when people talk about autism, they talk about it being a spectrum. Right. Because there's variant degrees of it, you know. And I think when we talk about stuff, we just kind of block it. And so, yeah, it's kind of like I'm like mentioning all our films right now because we talked about all this stuff. But in Everything Is Fine, Dr. West is in that film and he talks about, you know, on one level, you receive a diagnosis, and it's a great sense of relief.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, now I understand what's been going on all this time. But at the same level is somebody can then take that and become the diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
right? As opposed to I am somebody who has this issue, right? And creating separation between you and the illness and not conflating the two. And I think when we talk about mental illness specifically, or even like somebody like you, the way we talk about someone with autism, right? We say he is autistic, right? Like it's woven into the identity of the person as opposed to something that they're dealing with or living with or, you know?
I will say this. I do prefer person first language.
Yeah.
I know some people that hate it.
Yeah.
There's no consensus
yeah.
amongst people with schizophrenia as to what do you say, because there's a, can't think of, there's an influencer online that's like, I'm schizophrenic. I don't have schizophrenia. Uh-huh. And it's like, yeah, she has a legitimate diagnosis.
Yeah.
And that she does have that. She's not just trying to get attention.
Right.
But yeah, me, I very much prefer person first language.
Yeah.
But same thing with in the autistic community. I think a lot of them, I've heard people say, oh, it's a superpower. I like saying I'm that.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard a lot of people the other way, but yeah. I'm sure it's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's variant degrees to it. And the way you treat it and the way that we live with it, you know, and what works for me and what works for somebody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to kind of like know that and allow people to, you know, it's such, I think one of the big things is like we just judge ourselves so harshly.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from like this comparison. And who knows? Who told me to have this ideal of who I was supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I don't know that anyone directly walked up to me and said and painted this picture of this is who Christian's supposed to be. But some point in my life, I had created this image of who I was supposed to be. And I have never been able to live up to that image in my
mm-hmm.
mind, right? Which created so much doubt and hatred and self mutilation and I mean addiction and so much drama and pain in my life because I wasn't living to this made up ideal of who I was supposed to be. And when you share your story and you share your experience, I hear someone who is honest about where they're at. You have no problem admitting your limitations. You also have no problem exploring your creativity. And I mean, learning that you're a comedian 5 minutes before we got on here, I wish we had some like clips of your comedy, but like, it's cool. It's really inspiring. You know, I know that it's, I'm already better for knowing you. And I'm sure that everyone who's listened to this, is inspired to continue on whatever mission they're on. So thank you for being here and thank you for sharing so honestly.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. This is the Most High Show.